The American oil advisors in Baghdad after 2003 knew well what their colleagues in the international oil business wanted from Iraq: legal and financial clarity, and contract terms that allowed bookable reserves. If they had any doubts about that, oil executives arrived regularly in Baghdad to lobby them. Sam Laidlaw, a Chevron executive, turned up in Baghdad early on to see if he could represent a consortium of American companies to put possible production-sharing contract terms in front of the Iraqis and to find the right kind of financial vehicle that would get around the UN controls on Kuwaiti claims. When Iraqi political leaders heard that sort of talk about foreign ownership of the country's oil, it only inflamed the politics or kind of grassroots emotional issues of ownership of a national resource, recalled Norm Shidlovsky, a Chevron veteran who worked with McKee and Stenson as an advisor in Baghdad. Many people were convinced that the U.S. presence and the coalition was here to take their oil. The American oil advisors were wealthy men at the ends of their careers. They were not in Baghdad to make money, but rather to have an adventure and serve the Bush administration. Their outlook about the bookable reserve question was that, first, it was up to the Iraqis to decide, but second, in the long run, what was good for Iraq probably would also be good for Western oil companies. It seemed to the American advisors that Iraq's democratic government should first establish a strong national oil company comparable to the ones in Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, and many other Middle Eastern nations. A unified, integrated Iraqi national oil company and its political masters could provide Baghdad's politicians with a sounder footing to decide whether, as in Africa and some parts of Southeast Asia and Central Asia, the government wanted to invite foreign companies in and allow them to book some of Iraq's oil in exchange for capital and up-to-date technology, or try to go it alone, perhaps with service companies such as Halliburton and Schlumberger. "Although I'm a free marketer and a capitalist," Rob McKee observed, "it was very apparent to me and everybody else that Iraq needed a central energy policy." That had to precede decisions about sharing reserves with international companies. The invasion had shattered the old Iraqi state, effectively breaking its politics into sectarian and regional pieces tied together by a weak, continually renegotiated, inexperienced democratic regime in Baghdad, one lobbied heavily not only by the United States, but also by Iran. Year after year, the country's new leaders talked about oil policy reform, but they could not agree on a national oil law. During this interregnum, while ExxonMobil and other international majors hunkered down in Amman and Dubai, small-time operators and freelance wildcatters, Israelis working through Turkish front companies, Russians and American and British adventurers, turned up in the green zone looking for fast deals. Some individual wildcatters drove themselves by car from Jordan to Baghdad, barreling down insurgent-controlled highways, dumb and courageous at the same time, as McKee put it. The adventurers were aided by splits in Iraqi decision-making about how to sell oil. Coalition Provisional Authority Order No. 39 banned new contracts that would exploit Iraq's natural resources until an elected government in Baghdad could be seated under a new democratic constitution. Iraq's northern Kurdistan minority, however, which had organized itself under an entity it called the Kurdish Regional Government, ignored this edict. The best Iraqi oil fields lay in the Shiite-dominated south of the country and employed export pipelines leading to the Persian Gulf. The northern Kurdish regions contained large fields of heavier oil and natural gas, although options for overland export were limited. After 2005, Kurdish leaders interpreted Iraq's new constitution to mean that oil production would be locally managed by the people living in the regions. As the Kurdistan Regional Government's Minister of Natural Resources, Ashti Harami, put it. The Shiite-dominated government in Baghdad declared that Kurdish decision to be illegal and unconstitutional, but it found itself powerless to stop the KRG from letting contracts. To attract risk-takers to its legally disputed fields, the Kurds let production-sharing contracts with fully bookable reserves on terms designed to excite Western capitalists. Early takers included a small Norwegian producer, DNO, and a firm called Hunt Oil, headquartered in Dallas, which had multiple personal ties to the Bush White House. Shahristani and other oil ministry officials in Baghdad warned ExxonMobil, Chevron, Shell, BP, and other major international firms that if they tasted Kurdish crude, they would never, ever see a drop of Iraq's bigger oil fields in the south. They also declared the production-sharing contracts let to DNO and Hunt to be illegal under Iraqi law. Oliver Zandona and other industry lobbyists pushed the Bush administration in Washington after 2005 to sort out the Kurdish mess. "The policy question before us was, what do you do with these contracts?" recalled a Bush administration official involved in the discussions. "I have to say, I think we really screwed that one up." By failing to make absolutely clear that Western oil companies should not cut independent deals with the Kurds, and by winking at the Kurdish contracts that had been negotiated, the administration sent mixed signals to companies and Iraqi political leaders alike, and may have prolonged the country's debilitating stalemate over oil sharing. The Kurds were the most pro-American faction in Iraq, however. There was a natural bias inside the Bush administration to cut the Kurdistan regional government slack because of all the ways Kurds cooperated with Bush's state-building project. During 2005 and 2006, Megan O'Sullivan, the influential National Security Council official overseeing Iraq policy for the Bush administration, shepherded through a formal, classified, interagency policy review on Iraq's strategy, including a subsection on Iraq's oil. The aim was to promote oil as a means of finance and political unity for the struggling Iraqi state. That policy was formalized in 2006, briefed to President Bush, and dispatched to embassies worldwide by State Department cable. The Bush administration urged Iraq to negotiate a single national oil law that would account for Kurdish autonomy, clarify the legality of the Kurdish wildcatter contracts, and provide a basis for large-scale investment in the future by the likes of ExxonMobil. As a practical matter, however, because there was no sanction placed on companies such as DNO and Hunt Oil that were cutting side deals to pump Kurdish crude, the Bush administration effectively signaled neutrality on the matter, as if what was at issue in the Kurdish sidebar contracts was just a business dispute, not a potential fault line through Iraq's ethnic and sectarian fabric. A firmer policy would have sanctioned DNO and Hunt for jeopardizing Iraqi unity, or banned their dealings outright under American law.